the baby Jesus. It's Friday. A couple of days off for us. It's McCowan. It's Shannon.
But people can listen to the podcast on the weekend.
I don't care.
Well, I do.
The issue isn't what they're doing. The issue is what I'm doing.
Are you playing golf?
Well, I don't know that yet. I don't have any specific plans to play golf.
Okay.
I may be retiring from golf.
Really?
Well, I played once with you.
Yeah.
Which isn't really like golf at all.
What does that mean?
Well, hit it and look for John's ball.
Oh, so, stop it. Stop it.
And
I hit it stiff. I hit it stiff on the first hole from about 225.
And I paid no attention to it.
I know. You were out. You were in the bunker smoking a dart. That's what you were doing. It's unbelievable.
Anything to avoid watching your swing.
That is so hurtful.
It's not the least bit hurtful. You're laughing at it. JP Morosi, one of our all-time favorites, will join us. And we had news.
Breaking news.
We had breaking news today, and we're going to discuss it. The Indians are no more. They are now the Guardians. And we're going to address that. And I suspect because Morosi is a closet hockey fan. Well, he's not even in the closet.
No.
He is a hockey fan. Mm. Knowing you, Shannon, you will drag that part of the conversation.
I'd rather talk baseball.
Well, suspect we'll do both. We'll find out when Morosi joins us after these messages. It's McCowan. It's Shannon for this Friday. And we are joined by our buddy, our pal, our chum, JP Morosi is with us. And the timing could not be more perfect. As we sit here and chat and record this, the Cleveland Indians have announced within the last hour that they are changing their nickname from Indians to Guardians. Did you see this one coming? I mean, we know that they've been talking about trying to come up with something, but was the Guardians name ever rumored?
Well, Bob and John, good morning. I always enjoy being with you both here on the podcast. For me, a couple things. Number one, historically speaking, there was a movement behind the Spiders nickname. That was one of the older nicknames for a ball club in Cleveland, obviously going back a long time. That was one that we heard. I personally was a fan of the Cleveland Dobies, to name the team after Larry Doby. But I think Guardians is a name that was discussed a little bit, and I think it's a very good choice. It has that same, obviously from a standpoint of just the word itself, it ends in the same way that the current nickname ends. And so there's that symmetry, but it's also very different. And it speaks to, I think, Bob and John, you could really interpret the name Guardians in any number of ways. You're thinking about guarding a legacy, guarding as a city on a lake port, obviously where the sea is a big part of the ethos of Cleveland. As you both know, that's part of it. So there's a lot of different ways to interpret the name Guardians. The logo looks sharp. It reminds fans who wanted to stay connected to the old Indians nickname a little bit more. There are threads of it there, just in the way that the name sounds, mm-hmm. but it's also entirely different. It is obviously something that is entirely apart from from any sort of Native American or indigenous imagery or nomenclature. And I think for all those reasons, it's a very, very good choice.
And with the hot trend of things like Guardians of the Galaxy, it could potentially be something for a younger market as well.
It's a great point. It's a great point, John. It's something that really can apply any number of different ways. And you wonder, will there be a mascot? Will there be any sort of logo that's
a mascot. You know, there will be a mascot.
There you go. And I thought the video rollout, Tom Hanks narrating it, was very good. It was overall, I was very impressed and happy with the way they went. And obviously this was a process. When you think about it, guys, it's been arguably decades in the making from the original conversations back, I believe, in the 90s about the appropriateness of the original nickname to now today. I think overall it was a long journey. I probably would have liked it to have been a shorter one in terms of it getting started years ago, but they've gotten to a good place. I think it's hard for me to imagine anybody saying that this is an unacceptable endpoint for this discussion. I think it's a very acceptable name, and good on the club for having a lot of thought behind it.
The curious part for me is the timing of this announcement. Just before we started, I was asked by our producer, has this ever happened before where a team announced the changing of its nickname in the middle of a season? I can't think of another situation where that's happened. Can either of you?
It's a no. Great question. I can't. I recall when the Washington Bullets became the Wizards, mm-hmm. I believe that was in the offseason.
It was.
I think everyone, there haven't been that many that have changed, but I think traditionally you would do it in the offseason. We were just chatting about all the myriad of things you have to do. You don't just have to get new uniforms and new hats. You have logos everywhere through the stadium. You have to get new letterhead. You have to get change your office interior.
Hold on. People use letterhead still?
I imagine they do. I suspect that the Cleveland Guardians now have new letterhead and are going to throw the Indians letterhead out. And if they throw it out, somebody will go to the garbage can and grab it and believe that 50 years from now, it'll be worth $1 million.
Well, and I would point out quickly that they have in recent years moved in terms of the logo itself. They have phased out the Chief Wahoo logo even before this year, which was the right decision. And so now you see in many cases, it's that block C that is the standard logo for the club. And I would suspect even as the Guardians logo is a little different, that they may keep that block C as an alternate logo. Yeah. I think it's a very iconic and simple C. It's a good logo. And I also think it's important to point out too, that they can keep the same colors. The road uniforms, which I like are the simple gray with the Cleveland in blue script, blue block letters. That's a good one. So, I mean, there are some aspects, there are going to be enough of the threads of the heritage of the team from the way that they have looked for a long time that I would hope will reassure some who were opposed to the nickname change.
John, the two things come to mind for me. First of all, there have been rumblings this season about the Guardians leaving. There have been a few murmurs that, you know, they're not happy with, I think it's Progressive Field now, they're not happy with the stadium. They're not. And is there a chance that long-term this baseball club doesn't stay in Cleveland, which I find hard to believe? There's that. Plus, the other question I have is, does that put more pressure on the Atlanta baseball club to change its name?
Yeah, two great questions. I think number one, you know, there has been some rumbling a little bit just about the overall vitality of the business model there, given where attendance has been, given where the revenues have been. I would be stunned if we ever saw the Guardians leave. It's a charter member of the American League. They have had dips in attendance in the past. It's a really difficult thing for me to imagine. That being said, I think we're entering a time where some very serious questions are going to be asked of multiple franchises about where they are based and what their future is. We're already seeing it at Oakland right now, where in Oakland, it really does appear to me that MLB is having to have some pretty frank discussions about the possibility of relocating that franchise. There was a vote this week in city council in Oakland that was not at all what MLB was hoping. And the clock is now beginning to tick on Oakland, on Tampa Bay. I don't think Cleveland is nearly in that same realm, but it's worth keeping an eye on how their business model is going in the future. I would expect long-term the Guardians will remain in Cleveland. Now, as it relates to Atlanta, I do think, I'll make this point quickly, I think they should look at their nickname and give serious thought to changing it. Where they go on it and how much groundswell there is locally there to change it is still to be determined. One thing you wonder, of course, the All-Star Game was moved out of Atlanta for reasons that had nothing to do with the nickname this year. But if they change the nickname, if they make a concerted effort in this area going forward, does that help them get the All-Star Game back in the future? Perhaps it will.
Well, it raises a point that I know I've raised and brought up on numerous occasions. And let me clarify exactly what I've said in the last 15 or 20 years since this conversation has become upfront with regard to Native North Americans and nicknames. There are nicknames that are that were used, i.e. the Washington football team, that I understand would be offensive to a great many people. Indians may be among them. The Edmonton Eskimos of the Canadian Football League have recently changed their nickname. Yeah. The one, and let me clarify, I've often said a bunch of white people sitting around arguing the merit of teams changing nicknames because Native North Americans are object to it is a stupid exercise. The answer has always been go to them, find out definitively how offended they are or if they're offended at all, and react accordingly. It raises this question for me, guys. Would Braves be, my connotation of Braves is that it's almost honorable and not offensive, but it is still a reference to, an historic sector of the population.
Right. Yeah. But North Dakota, University of North Dakota nickname was the Fighting Sioux, which is as honorable. Middle-aged white guy, Fighting Sioux looks like it's supposed to honor the indigenous people of that area of the United States. But there was a ton of pressure and they had to change.
Yep.
You have to be respectful of the group and go from there. This perception that the Cleveland baseball team changed quickly, changed in the end without any fuss or muss and made it look like a positive, I think will pressure a lot of sports teams with these types of nicknames to change. And the next one that will come up will be the Chicago Blackhawks. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah. And again, I offer no real opinion or insight into it. Yeah. I don't think we should. I think it should be a decision made by those that are directly affected by it. And we should honor that, their wishes.
Absolutely.
The intriguing thing about the Guardians potentially leaving is that you will well recall, although I know you pay very little attention to any sporting event that happens in the state of Ohio, Mr. Michigan. nonetheless, it was, I was going to say not so many years ago, it was quite a few years ago. It seems like yesterday, Art Modell in the middle of the night packed up the bus and the Cleveland Browns and moved them to Baltimore in a not dissimilar scenario where he was unhappy with the city and with the stadium and the facilities and the deal that he could get. And he just moved. Is it so far-fetched to think that the Cleveland baseball team, I'm not saying would do the same thing, but Cleveland has lost its hockey team. They lost its football team, eventually got it back. There's a history of this happening, JP.
There is precedent. I would say that the old Cleveland Municipal Stadium is a fundamentally different place, or was a fundamentally different facility than Progressive Field. I've always loved Progressive Field. I think the ballpark still works exceptionally well. It's in a great location right next to the basketball arena. It's right downtown. I would have a real issue with saying that the facility was in any way the reason for them leaving. It's still a wonderful major league ballpark in my opinion. And it was only built in the 90s. And I realized that by the way, we have already seen two parks that were inaugurated in the 90s, Turner Field in Atlanta and Globe Life Park in Texas have already now moved on. I mean, that's one of the more surprising things, that ballparks that we recall from the last 25 to 30 years being built are now being phased out. But I would say in those cases, Arlington and Atlanta, location was a significant issue. I'm not sure where you would put a ballpark in Cleveland other than where it is right now. It's in a great spot.
Well, and they did a marvelous, I mean, having been to Cleveland a few times in the last couple of years, the whole concept of what they did with the field house, with the baseball stadium, with the football stadium, was a huge part of revitalizing downtown.
Right.
And did change the personality of downtown Cleveland, which has to be viewed as a positive. I was shocked when I read all this stuff that there were rumblings, and perhaps it's just ownership trying to get leverage.
Well,
trying to create a better business opportunity in a market that, I mean, Cleveland's not growing. That's the one thing you would say. Cleveland as a city is not growing. And so where you're expected to revenues to grow every year, where do the revenues grow if your city isn't growing in size, where a lot of the cities in the south half of the United States are growing exponentially?
And I think, John, sorry to cut you off. I was mentioning about the attendance. I mean, attendance there has been low for a long time. That's right. Is a fact. That you look, it's been one of the lowest attended teams in a while for many, many years. And I think this really speaks to the unique balance that baseball is trying to strike, whether it's the Cleveland now Guardians or the league office overall, is threading that needle between the heritage of the game and now the future of the game. Do you spend and invest a lot of time, to your point, moving franchises to Vegas, to Nashville, because you feel like they're going to be the places in the country that are growing the most? How do you feel about Portland, Oregon? Obviously, the three of us have talked a lot about Montreal in the past. I believe firmly that should be top of the line in terms of a franchise moving there because of the size of the city, the market, the media rights in two languages, all the reasons that we've discussed before. But this Cleveland is now a microcosm of the issues in front of baseball right now. Do you double down on the heritage of a charter American League franchise and city and really embrace that and sell the history? Or do you have to put your product in markets that are new and exciting and almost separate yourself from that? It's honestly similar things to what the NHL was going through 25 years ago. And in some cases it's worked, and in some cases it hasn't. We saw obviously Atlanta go back to Winnipeg, and the situation in Phoenix is still dicey from the standpoint of their building and what their future is. So there are some that have been successful and some that are not. And then of course you've got a Sun Belt team that is back-to-back Stanley Cup champion and the model franchise of the league. So it's like a lot of things. There's a mixture of great stories and those that are still very much in progress.
Well, that's the whole point, is that there's no commonality in the on-field performance as it relates to the desire of the franchise to move. It is principally about attendance. Tampa Bay, of course, has had a very good team for a long period of time. Can't draw flies. Cleveland Indians have had some very good baseball teams. It's been a while since they had a really bad one. Can't draw. Oakland A's have been very competitive for a number of years. Can't draw. That they're talking about Vegas. Baltimore, I don't think is going anywhere, but their attendance is way down, but they've had a crappy baseball team on the field. So it's hard to analyze, and we like to put square things in square boxes here, but sometimes it's not fair to do that. Each situation in many ways is very different.
But it's all about, in the, you said attendance, Bob, it's all about revenue.
Well, and that's a revenue attendance, you know.
But the other part of this is that the pot of gold that has been so prevalent for 25 years in all sports in the United States, in which has been regional television, regional cable sports television, might be drying up. It is a changing, shifting dynamic right now, with what has gone on with the people who have bought all the old Fox Sports regionals and the Sinclair Group. And it is changing, and rights fees aren't growing exponentially anymore. That's the one thing. The other thing is, and John, this is happening, I know it's happening in our country with legislation coming, but how much are baseball teams now trying and waiting and fingers crossed, waiting for gambling money? Waiting for sports betting?
Well, I think we're already seeing those elements become more part of the game. It's, if you watch a large production, the All-Star Game, for example, you will see advertisements and partnerships with sports gambling that you would have never seen 5 years ago. It's a huge part of the game. And I think that monetizing those aspects of the sport, to your point, as television revenues and the local television dynamic changes, and more people who are millennials and younger are perhaps cord cutters and not getting the normal cable packages. As those habits change, you have to find ways to monetize your sport in different ways to build exactly what you're describing, John, is that sustainable central baseball revenue stream of infrastructure. And maybe as you look at the pie of your revenues, you have attendance, you have local TV, you have national TV, you have advanced media, you have now sports gambling as part of it. Yeah. And that pie is going to shift around different percentages. But if the local TV portion of the pie is going to restrict a little bit, then that's where the expanded revenues from the gambling partnerships will fill that gap. And I think we all have to accept that the sport is changing. And there are certainly ways to have sports gambling revenues part of your sport while maintaining competitive integrity. And I do think that's now going to be one of the key things baseball looks at in the years to come.
Let me ask you a question. I'm going to do a supposition, and I'm not suggesting this is going to happen next week. But my fear, and I admit I'm an old guy, I'm a bit of a television purist as well as a sports purist, but I'm not sure I'm ready for Vladimir Guerrero going to the plate and a graphic comes up and an announcer says, by the way, will Vladimir Guerrero hit a home run? Here's your prop bet, and it's 6-1. Whatever. I don't even gamble, so I don't even know the verbiage.
No, but John, you can say that it's not possible.
Oh no! I think it's going to happen, and I'm not very happy about it.
I don't think it's going to happen at all. However many people gamble on sports, there are a significant number, at least as many, who do not and would be grossly offended by that, myself included. And I have been in and around the gambling community virtually my whole life. I don't want to see that. Now, if you want to create a secondary channel, whether it's a YouTube channel, a computer channel, a different channel on my cable or satellite that allows me, has a different feed and has that kind of stuff on the screen, okay, I'm not watching it, but go ahead. The gamblers can all watch that, but you can't put it on the main channel. I don't think you're ever, ever, ever going to see that.
Or you do it through an
app.
And
I'll be willing to bet you on it. How about that?
or you do it via an app. I mean, and that I think is now And that is where, you know, one thing about baseball, and this is where I understand. I understand, first of all, the sensitivities of what you're describing, but also one thing about baseball, and we've talked about wherever attendance is, wherever television ratings are. First of all, this is a business at its core. The other part is one thing about baseball that the people in charge of the sport fully realize is that we in baseball, because of the nature of the game, you have so many natural pauses, inning breaks, pause between batters, that actually, if you wanted to have discrete amounts of wagering within the game, there's probably no better major sport to do it, because you could say, hey, so Vlad's walking to the plate. You get onto your app and they could close it off at certain times where maybe you have to almost be in the stadium to be able to wager on it. Do you have a wager in terms of, do you expect them to walk, hit, record an out, strike out, home run, whatever it is, but you could do that for every single at bat. And especially if you're at the ballpark, and maybe there is a specific phone that you pick up in a club level seat and you can basically do that the entire evening. It's an interesting thought, and it's something that is there. And
let me tell you,
I can order my hot dog off my phone. I'm going to be able to bet on my phone, but that's my concern.
Yeah. But really, guys, here's one thing you have to understand is that for every transaction, every proposition that is placed in front of you, somebody, a line maker, a bookmaker, has to determine odds.
Yeah.
Not everything is a 50-50 proposition. That takes time. It doesn't necessarily take a long time, but the notion of being able to bet on every swing of the bat or even every at bat right now is sort of a foreign enterprise. Not only that, line makers want to be able to adjust that line if they get an overwhelming reaction on one side of a proposition or the other. A bookmaker is trying to balance his books. He would like to have the same amount bet on one side of the proposition, the same amount on the other, and then he takes his percentage off the losing bets. If you're doing it that rapidly, you don't have time to set a line. And a line is critical. You know, a 120 hitter with no home runs in his career comes to the plate. The chances of hitting a home run are not the same as Vladimir Guerrero hitting a home run. And somebody's got to make that determination. And is that going to be done at the beginning of a game?
Well, it's
maybe, but it's not going to be done.
It's either somebody, Bob, or some automated artificial intelligence program that does it in real time.
Right. And by the way, Bally Sports did not buy 17 or create a partnership with Sinclair for 17 regional sports networks to toast bread. They didn't. They did it to do on-screen gambling. That's why they did it.
Well, I acknowledge that. All I'm trying to explain is that this notion that you guys got into of pitch by pitch at this moment in time is rather unrealistic, and nobody's doing it. I'm not saying it can't be done. Technology is what it is.
Oh, there's an algorithm. I guarantee you there's an algorithm. There's a guy in an office in Las Vegas that has an algorithm, and he's ready to hit the button. I'm being defeatist about it because I don't want it to clutter my screen. And if I have a choice, as you talked about, between, you know, the main channel and the gambling channel, I'll take the main channel and I'll be happy. Yeah. But I'll tell you what, I guarantee you during that show on the main screen, they are going to try to drive me to the other channel. And it's an inevitability right now. The last 3 years in at least three sports, baseball, hockey, and basketball, I have heard about the growing opportunity of prop bets during games. And it's going to happen. I don't want it to happen, but I'm not a gambler and I don't want it to clutter my screen.
You make bets ever, Morosi?
Nope. I don't. I really don't. It's foreign to me. I stay out of it. I don't even pick an NCAA tournament pool. I have no interest in it. Busy enough with just trying to get the information right in my own little lane. But I'm like John from the standpoint of, I just like to look at the results as they happen in front of me through the competitive lens. And
I'm in an audience that is dwindling. I understand that. And I respect that. But you know what? There is at a certain point, there is a freedom of choice.
We want to get to hockey because Morosi,
can I ask one more question then? Can I just one more question?
I couldn't stop you even if I wanted.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. John, you tweaked me to something about 15 minutes ago before we got onto the gambling thing. And I was thinking about the four commissioners, Roger Goodell, Gary Bettman, Adam Silver, Rob Manfred. I would suggest to you that I think Rob Manfred of the four right now has the toughest job.
I agree for any number of reasons. Well, first of all, there's a CBA being discussed right now. Relations with the players union have not been great for the last couple of years. I do think they're getting better, by the way. I do think they're getting better. So the combination of labor relations plus the demographics of the fan base of the sport moving in the direction that they are. And it's so interesting to me, though, because, guys, we look at this and you consider the amount of young talent in the game. I always chuckle a little bit when people criticize baseball's marketing or where we're at as a sport. Because if you watch Shohei Ohtani, Vlad Jr., Acuna when he's healthy, DeGrom when he's healthy, these are transcendent players, Tatis, who are all young. DeGrom's not super young, but still an ascendant star. I just named five players who are scintillating to watch play. And I always say, wait a minute. When people say, well, you're not marketing the sport enough. Well, guys, if you like baseball, you love the product right now with these players. Now, I granted, the game itself, and this is part of why Rob Manfred's job is so hard, the game itself has gone through some challenges. The sticky substance enforcement.
The Houston bat thing. The Houston issue. You know?
That was a huge issue too, and remains one that people are still upset about to this day. So there are some gameplay on the field questions. There are some competitive integrity questions as it relates to the sticky stuff, to the Houston cheating scandal, etc. But at the end of the day, guys, we have in this sport so much incredible young talent that I really take issue with the critics who say, "Well, baseball's done a poor job of marketing the sport." To me, I think. If someone says that, there's a very high chance they're not watching the sport anyway or don't love the sport anyway. It's not baseball's job to convince you to love baseball if you're not already predisposed to enjoy the game. I really think that sometimes baseball is held to an unfair standard there. And if you watch Ohtani, what he does, and Tatis and Vlad, and you say, no thanks. Well, yeah. Then I'm sorry, then you're probably not a baseball fan to begin with. This is our sport. We're proud of it. There's no need for me to apologize for it or to bend over backwards for those that aren't going to necessarily watch your sport on a regular basis anyway.
Yeah, see, that's kind of my point, John. And I did watch a bit of the All-Star game, and I don't think I watched all of it, but I was amazed at how many new faces, new young faces. I believe the number was of the 60 players over there, 40 were there for the first time. And it really indicated to me that the youth movement within baseball and the young talent within baseball was just exploding. And so I think with the rules that need to be changed, the length of games, the relationship with the players, I just see Rob Manfred just getting bombarded every day with another challenge, right. Another challenge. And the other guys seem to be, even Bettman, you know, and Seattle's had a good week for him. Even Gary is at the point where saying, "Hey, I'm having a great day today." I don't see Rob Manfred having many great days right now, and that must be frustrating.
Well, I'll make one point quickly. We saw at the All-Star game, one of my favorite things, and John, you can appreciate this with your long history in television, the ability to mic up players and have them talk with Joe Buck and John Smoltz during the game, which again, it's, you can't really do that during a World Series game, but that is deciding a championship. But for an All-Star game where you're marketing your stars, that was a great job by Fox and their crew, Pete Macheska and Matt Gangle and John and Joe, to do it that way. And then I think by the players, you have to credit them for being open-minded. It's not easy to wear a live mic when you're playing a baseball game and you're broadcasting your words all around the world. I just think that was a really cool insight. And again, when you watch that broadcast, John and Bob, and you see Freddie Freeman and how genuine he is, and you see the emotion and the collegiality of the players, I think everybody turned off the TV that night feeling like they really got to know the stars of today a lot better. And yeah, they felt more connected.
Who was watching the game? It's guys like us who are already baseball fans. That isn't the issue. The issue is, how do you increase the viewership? How do you get the younger generation to absorb the game, to love the game the way we did a variety of years ago? John and I a little more than you, but nonetheless, you grew up a baseball fan, so did we. Today, there are fewer and fewer young people that gravitating towards baseball. And I want to point this out too. I'm intrigued by your notion of this. I'm the crotchety old guy, get off my lawn. I make no apologies for that. I hate this idea, but I'm coming to the point where I'm going, I don't know what else you can do. Baseball has, we saw 7-inning doubleheader for the Toronto Blue Jays, what, about a week or so ago, 10 days ago.
Yeah. Double shutout.
I got to tell you, the 7-inning baseball game, they have not been able to figure out how to shorten these games. If anything, they just get longer and longer. Maybe a 7-inning game is where we should be headed. The problem with that, of course, is it takes the record books and history and essentially throws it out the window, right?
Yep.
Right. Yep. And you basically start over. No game that I can think of has undergone that dramatic a change.
I mean, Bob, this was a sport that couldn't fathom going from 154 to 162. In the amount of games played in a season and how that would affect the record book. I mean, it took how many, there are still people that think it's not fair. So,
well, you know, I'd go back to 154, but that's not the issue. That doesn't get you more fans having eight fewer games or more playoff teams.
No, but I'm just talking about how it affected the record book.
I'm talking about how do you turn what used to be. Roy Halladay got on the mound. You guys remember this. Roy Halladay got on the mound, and 2 hours later, you were looking for something else to do because the game was over.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't happen anymore. Now we're at three plus a lot, sometimes 4 hours for a nine-inning baseball game. That's no good. The TV networks aren't going to cut down the commercial time. Pitchers are not speeding up play. You can put a clock up there, but that clock's going to probably be, what's the one they use in the minor leagues, Morosi? 25-second clock?
Right, it's around there, yes.
That's not going to tangibly speed things up. You know, maybe that carves a minute or two off the game. The problem isn't a minute or two. The problem is a half hour or more.
Well, I will say this. A lot of it, and this goes back to something Commissioner Selig would always talk about, it's not the pace or the time of the game, but the pace of the action. And you want things happening with balls in play. And one thing with all the controversy of the sticky stuff and the immediate blowback to the enforcement, you've had one person suspended, Hector Santiago, one suspension. And while the checks are a little awkward, they have had their desired effect, which is we are seeing more balls in play. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more offense. And we're seeing the games, the pace of them, they're a little bit quicker now, or at least there's more action per minute spent at the ballpark.
I still don't think it's enough to lure a new generation of fans, but we have to take a break, John. So,
Bob, let's go to commercial.
Thank you. Morosi is with us. We're going to take a pause, and then we're going to talk hockey because that's what he loves. Back after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, it's John Paul Morosi.
We didn't even get to Nelson Cruz.
Well, you guys decided at the beginning of this show, let's talk some hockey. So I've now given you 38 minutes of baseball talk.
You're so generous.
Well, you know, we don't have all that much time for
what hockey. About Nelson Cruz, John?
All right, quickly on Nelson Cruz. The Tampa Bay Rays get Cruz. I thought that all along he was a better fit there than he would have been in Toronto. I don't think that any Jays fans should be worried about the work of Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins and not getting Nelson Cruz. He was a better fit in Tampa all along. They paid a good price for him. He's going to really help them. That's a bat that they were lacking last year during the World Series. So the division got a lot tougher. There's no question about it. And now I think it's up to the Jays, from my perspective, to shore up their starting pitching with a controllable starting pitcher. And maybe get a bullpen piece in the same deal. Well, there's a couple names. I would say one team to watch. We see the Twins are open for business right now with trading Cruz to Tampa. I would say this. Jose Berrios in the rotation, and then Rogers as well out of the bullpen. That combination, that tandem, would be incredibly appealing. And if I'm the Jays, I would give up a Nate Pearson as part of that deal. I would give up either Groshans or Martin as part of that deal. This is a team that can win it, at least win the division if they really get going right now. But this is a dangerous playoff team, and you cannot spoil and waste a season in which you've got Marcus Semien entering free agency, who's very quickly become a really important player on this team, and you've got Vlad playing like a triple crown winner. These are years where when you've got key contributors like this playing at their peak, you can't waste the opportunity. So I think for the Jays, to find a deal where you can get a starter and reliever in the same trade from one team is where they should go right now.
So how much of the future do you mortgage for the Jays?
As long as the player is controllable, you give up. I would trade Nate Pearson today if it got me a Jose Berrios or a Luis Castillo or a Germán Márquez, and I would include a Groshans or a Martin if I had to. Because I think Pearson, he has not been consistently healthy. I have worries about his consistency right now. And the Jays, as their rotation currently sits, it's not good enough to win the division right now. And they need more. And, oh, by the way, they have to protect against the future because Robbie Ray is only on a one-year deal. So they have to look at what their 2022 rotation looks like as well.
Although Robbie Ray has indicated he likes the organization and wants to stay. He signed very quickly during the offseason to this one-year deal. Really didn't explore very much else. Anyway, there's lots of places to go with that conversation. Sure. Can we please now? I can't believe I'm asking you.
Yeah, I'm ready for hockey. I've been ready for hockey since the top of the show.
All right, let me start with by saying this. it's too early to know whether Seattle did a good job or a bad job on Wednesday with the expansion draft. But I'll tell you, there's the more I think about it, the more I look around and the less I hear. I think they did a mediocre to poor job of assembling talent. I think they overestimated what teams would give them to protect players. And I don't think they're going to come within miles of what Vegas accomplished. And we shouldn't use that as the bar because that was extraordinary. But they don't look anything close to a playoff team to me. Your thoughts?
I think they're a playoff contender. I do. I think that they...
Only because they're in the Pacific.
Exactly. So a few things are the reason why. Number one, to John's point, the division, you've got the three California teams who have all been very strong at different points in the last decade are now all rebuilding in various stages. So I really think right now the roster that Seattle has on paper at this moment is better than the three California teams. So then you're basically talking about, okay, can you find a way to crack into the top three with obviously Vegas being probably the best team in this division? And then can you finish ahead of one or two of Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary? Calgary's got a roster that is, as we know, very much in transition. They just lost their captain to Seattle. I think Seattle's goaltending is going to be better than people expect. I think Driedger is a more than capable goaltender. His numbers in the regular season were actually better than Price's from a standpoint of goals against. He's a good goalie. And their defense is going to be, I think, excellent. I'm a big fan of Oleksiak, big fan of Larson. I think Giordano is going to be very good. I've always liked Dunn. Soucie is a good player from Minnesota. I think that their defensive core is solid. And one thing, Bob, that I really think, and I'll be curious to hear John's thoughts on it too, Vegas making the cup final in year one, to your point, Bob, was a total anomaly, unique set of circumstances for a variety of reasons. Remember this. The cap is going to be flat for a while. Who is the only team in the NHL that looks at their books right now and says, we have zero contracts on our books that we would have rather not signed? The only team is Seattle. Everybody else signed a deal at some point in time in the last few years that they don't love right now.
They've had one day of signing contracts.
Right, but that's the point. And so, Bob, for me, if you're charting a course for the organization, you have two options. Either you go all in to try to win the cup in year one, which means you would take a chance on a Ryan Johansson, or you would go and get JVR or Voracek from the Flyers or Price or Tarasenko and just go all in all these contracts to have the best possible team in year one. Or you take a more cautious approach with respect to the cap while realizing that at the deadline this year and the next offseason, you're going to have other teams in the league who are feeling the pain of the choices they made 2 and 3 years ago when they thought the cap was going to be going up. Trust me, Seattle's going to get good players at the deadline this year and at the summertime next year who are directly related to bad decisions that happened years ago where they can now take advantage of other teams' mistakes.
All right, well, just quickly before John jumps in, you know, you called Vegas an anomaly. Well, they may have been an anomaly, but they were not a fluke. This is a team that has been competitive at the top of the NHL for 4 years now. So that was no fluke. The job that they did in putting that team together was beyond brilliant. And yes, it wasn't all just draft day. It was deals done before and deals done after. But how many draft choices did McPhee wound up with? Seven? Something like that? Did he trade for John?
He had more than that.
Maybe 11. Almost,
yeah, I think he more than doubled. He more than doubled his, you know, you start with seven. So I think he more than doubled what he had. He had three first round picks the first year because of what he did.
Well,
now his asset management, some people will sit here and criticize Vegas's asset management because all of those draft picks are gone.
Yeah.
He traded them to get, I mean, in the end,
including Suzuki.
Nick Suzuki for Max Pacioretty, who was better in that series. It was Nick Suzuki was better in that series. You know, there are some things there. Listen, I think what Vegas did was remarkable. The issue for me with Seattle is I don't agree with you on the goaltending, John. And I don't agree with you on the forwards. I do agree on the defense, and because I think they're big and they're, you know, they're strong and they're going to be a force in that division. But I also trust Ron to think that he has a bit of, he must have some sort of plan. You know, there are teams that are in cap hell right now, like Tampa, that are going to be forced to get rid of. Julian Brisebois has already admitted he has to get rid of a couple of players more in order to be camp compliant before the season starts. So that's going to be where Ron Francis becomes, you know, their guardian angel to save them from themselves. And he's going to end up with better players. But I do think, I think they're going to go and find another goaltender. I really believe that. And I think they need to find some goal scoring. I just don't know. Like Brandon Tanev, I love. Jonas Donskoy, I really like. Jared McCann can shoot the puck, but I'm not satisfied that they're the guys that can score goals for me in the long term.
Well, so go ahead. Would you have taken Bailey instead of Eberle?
Totally.
Okay.
I would have taken Josh Bailey, and I would have taken Jake Bean out of Carolina too.
Yeah, he's a good puck-moving defenseman.
Sure, he is. But that's, you know, but and you know, that's, hey, that's the conjecture of. They took 30 players. I will wonder how many of the 30 players, and they only, you know, can only dress 20. How many of the 30 will be in the opening night roster on October 12th against the Golden Knights?
Well, and they can also trade, as you know, John, they can trade some of the defensemen given how much need there is across the league for defense. And yeah. I also think that one thing we don't know, and this is one of the great things about hockey, is with different usage patterns for a player like Yanni Gourde, for other players that might be able to increase their goal scoring output when they're getting the prime power play time, when they're getting all the primo offensive zone starts on draws. Those kinds of things can boost a player's production somewhat organically, sure, just with a different role.
That's a cup half full mentality. And the challenge becomes is maybe Yanni Gourde was best used as the third line center. And when he gets the being the number two guy or the number one guy, he doesn't perform as well. There's another side of that coin, and that's really the challenge. I mean, look at there are tons of players that when they get elevated to the top six, just don't perform at that level.
Right, and they have to know is there a Marchessault on this team? We don't know that yet. We don't know if there's a Carlson on this team. And the one guy that I would say that maybe a Voracek would have been or a JVR would have been. I think the one player that I'm not seeing an analog for on this roster, John and Bob, is James Neal. When Vegas had James Neal was a veteran winger who could score goals, and he had presence about him, that confidence that you guys both know well that James has. That was a huge part of that Vegas team. And I don't know that there's a player on this Seattle roster who reminds me of James Neal. And I think that was an automatic, almost like mark it down 20 plus goals. Don't worry about it. And I'm not so sure how many players that this Seattle team has like that.
Well, I agree. And I mean, I think we have to mention Carlson too, a guy who essentially came out of nowhere and scored 44. Mm-hmm. And I mean, is there that guy on this roster in Seattle right now?
Well, you don't know. You just don't know.
Don't know.
You just don't know. They don't have very. If they have one position that they, I think they would admit that they're a little light on, and that's center, which is one of the toughest positions to populate in the NHL.
Correct. And by the way, it's not as though the free agent class is rich in that area either. No. There are not a bunch of centers out there to sign. I mean, unless do you go the veteran route and look at someone like a Paul Stastny and see if he'll come in and play center to sort of help your lineup depth at that position? Maybe. But again, Paul Stastny's not going to be a 80-point player right now necessarily. You
know? Paul Stastny wants to play on a contender.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, that's why he went back to Winnipeg. He thought he was going to a contender.
Well, let's be honest. Every player, if they were given truth serum, would say they want to play for a contender and win a Stanley Cup. Nobody wants to go to an expansion team unless you're a young player who isn't being given an opportunity where you are and you understand that you're blocked from ever getting that opportunity. And the opportunity isn't just to play a lot or score more goals. It's to make money.
What's going to happen next next week on the 28th is that there's going to be lots of players that I think Ron will go after, and he'll offer that player $3.5 million to sign in Seattle. And another team that has more upside right now will offer the same and a single year deal. And the player will opt not to go to Seattle.
Well, of course, that's my point, John.
Yeah.
Nobody will apples to apples. You're not going to an expansion team because the prospect of winning at the end of all this, these are all athletes. And the objective is to win. Yes, you want to make a lot of money, but you want to win. The prospect of winning in Seattle is not imminent, even with the Vegas history. Vegas turned that, like a team, if Vegas and Seattle were in competition for the same player, where are you going to go?
Well, and there's no question, too, that Vegas is a substantially better team now than they were in year one. I mean, even as they fell to Montreal in that series, you look at the talent on that roster, Petrangelo, Pacioretty, Stone, Martinez, Leonard. I mean, they had stars that were not part of that inaugural team. They just didn't score goals at the end. Stone had a bad series. Max had a bad series. You know, a couple bounces here and there, and if they have a better series by a couple players, they probably win that series. It's just – and Petrangelo was tremendous. He was one of the – he was probably still the best player in the series on either team.
You're right.
So there's a lot to like about this Vegas roster now, and they're going to remain the standard. And then, oh, by the way, they'll be in the very same division as Seattle here as they get going.
Yeah, their offense went ice cold against Montreal, and that was the end of that. That was the difference. Well, we'll have lots of time to talk about the Seattle Kraken. But it won't be today because we've kept you long enough.
Well, no, we got to talk to John about the Michigan draft. Isn't this the Michigan draft?
Right. Sure. This is, we should actually be hosting. I mean, Bob and John, if you'd like to send a message to Commissioner Bettman, I mean, I would actually propose that we have the entire draft in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
That's where all the talent is, Bob, my friend.
How many in the top 10? Four or five?
I think four. I think we get four. I think it's going to be Power 1, Beniers 2 to Seattle.
Yeah.
I think Luke Hughes is going to be a top 5 pick. And then I think Kent Johnson goes 10th or a little bit earlier. Yeah. And they're all, guys, so talented. This is going to be the first team. How about this? Michigan with and I know Bob's rolling his eyes behind those sunglasses, but you got Power 1, Beniers 2. It's going to be the first team since the Montreal Junior Canadiens of 1969. As Bob leaves, the first team since 1969 to have the number one and number two overall picks. Matty Beniers.
And that was Mark Tardif and Reggie who?
Reggie who? Exactly. That's it. Yeah, yep. Yeah, 1969. So, you got it.
Nothing more to say.
Oh, stop. I loved your piece with the boys that was on
thank you, John,
on the NHL Network. It was solid. I really do have my fingers crossed that somehow, some way that either the Devils or the Canucks
can get
Luke to play with either Jack or Quinn. I really
do.
I think that'd be cool.
I'd love it. And it's interesting walking in. They're such a wonderful family. Jim and Ellen are just incredible people. And it was fun to walk to their home. They have in their garage, you know, of course, the very popular tailgate game that they would have in Columbus or Ann Arbor, cornhole, right? So like the beanbag tossing. So there's the cornhole boards in that garage. There is one that's painted up with the Canucks and one that's painted up with the Devils. And so I wondered, like my big question walking in was, do they need to get a third one or not? Right. Is there not going to be the need to get a third one after the draft? It's going to be so much fun. What an amazing family. And they've already done a lot for U.S. hockey and certainly more to come in the years.
Well, and Jimmy was with the Maple Leafs when I was at the Maple Leafs. And
sure,
he's an unbelievably wealth of knowledge. And it's rubbed off on the kids. Rubbed off on the
family.
Kids.
Yeah. He and Ellen both. I mean, just their knowledge of the game and just to be there and just sort of absorb the love in the family and the conversations about the game is a real treat.
But to finish my part, just to drive Bob nuts even more. I mean, Mel Pearson deserves a ton of credit.
Yes.
I mean, what this guy has done and Red Berenson's is a friend of mine. And I've spent a lot of time with Red over the years, but what Mel Pearson has done to recruit players to play in Ann Arbor is absolutely unbelievable.
It really is. It really is. And I'll make this last little note to kind of tie it all into a bow about the top of the draft. And you'll appreciate this. So, of course, as you know, the Hughes family was living in Toronto for a while when Jim was working there. On the same field lacrosse team was Owen Power playing attack, not defense, by the way. He's playing attack in field lacrosse. He was playing on the same field lacrosse teams as Jack and Luke Hughes.
Wow.
In alternating years. So how about that? You could have gone to a field in Mississauga in lacrosse and seen three top 10 picks and two overall NHL number one picks playing on the same lacrosse team.
Well, I want to say, honestly, how pleased I am that Michigan has produced such great hockey players, because you haven't had a good football player in so many years.
Argument here, Bob. No argument here.
Well, you can't argue. It's an impossibility. It's
except the, I mean, the GOAT's still playing. The GOAT is still playing.
He is. Yeah, I believe he won the Super Bowl, Bob. Is that true still?
Yeah, and he played at Michigan 25 years ago.
20 years ago. 20 years ago, exactly.
Well, yeah, and he wasn't even the number one quarterback when he started there. So
right? Wow.
And he wasn't that great when he was at Michigan either. I got news for you.
Oh, yeah.
He escaped.
What are you going to bring up Rex Kern and Art Schleister? What are you going to do?
Well, but now you're going back to the Woody Hayes era and Schembechler. And I acknowledge back then Michigan was the better team. They had the better teams.
Okay.
That, of course, is a lifetime ago.
Okay. We could do an entire hour on that rivalry alone, but
we might do that anyway.
We've been doing it for 20 years anyway.
That's true.
All right. Get lost. It's lovely to see you as always. We'll bug you somewhere soon. Okay.
I love the conversation, my friends. Really enjoyed it. Happy draft day. It's going to be a lot of fun tonight. Thank you so much.
See you, Morosi. JP Morosi. We'll come back after these messages. Our thanks to JP Morosi for
he was on a roll today.
Well, more you were on a roll. You wouldn't shut up.
Well, it was fun. It was good
dragging
talk.
Dragging the conversation out.
Not dragging it out there. I mean, just reflecting what the listeners want to hear about. All these things.
How do you know what the listeners?
I talk to the people.
Well, stop doing that. That will do you no good whatsoever.
I talk to the people.
If they were as smart as you and I, they'd have their own podcast.
Don't say that. They probably do.
Most of them do. Yeah. God, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a podcast someplace, right?
Yeah, the days of one podcast and it's just ours.
We're actually coming up to our 200th episode in about a week.
Really?
I don't know how we're going to celebrate. Maybe we won't.
200. I mean, come on. 200. How many shows do you think you did?
Oh, I used to know the exact number.
Like 30,000? 30,000. Yeah. No, on Telegraph. Go ahead.
I'd have to do the math. No, it's not 30,000. I've taken over 50,000 phone calls.
Wow. But you won't take mine.
I'm sorry, your name was again?
Yeah, that's right. First time caller, Bob.
Well, that would have got you through. I can't remember the shows. It's about, I'm going to guess, 12,000 shows.
And do you remember any interviews? Like, does this somebody other than, you can't say Ali. Do you remember any interviews?
Why can't I say Ali?
That's an anything but Gretzky, anything but McDavid thing. You know, you can't say that because that's easy. That's easy.
Ali, Bear Bryant.
Okay, Bear Bryant. Okay.
Jim Brown.
Yeah.
The answer is generally no.
Yeah.
And I think you know that about me. I walk out of the studio and I shut that door.
Because we have mutual friends that we work with over the years, and somebody will say, hey, do you remember the game we did in 1991? And it was such a great game, and so-and-so had 5 goals. And I will say, I have no recollection. I have no recollection of that event.
This is an honest-to-God truism, and I think you know this, but for people watching or listening, I cannot tell you how many times we got off the air at 7 o'clock Eastern time. It took me 20 minutes to come home. There'd be people in my backyard. And somebody would ask me, I didn't hear the show. Who'd you have on today? And I would go, I don't remember. 20 minutes after the show.
I believe that.
I just,
it's
gone.
It's the magic alive.
In any event, John, you have yourself a good weekend. Okay.
Thank you, Bob. Olympics has started.
Oh, yeah. Opening ceremonies were this morning.
Yeah.
This morning, tonight.
Olympics have started. Actually, they started 2 days ago.
NBC, in their inimitable fashion, will be airing the opening ceremonies in September.
No, come on. People are used to, I mean, they ran them live this morning. They ran them live this morning. Then they're going to replay them tonight. Them.
To hell with NBC and the U.S. networks who treat the Olympics like a toy. and run nothing live and everything on tape delay.
I don't think that's true anymore. I don't think that's true anymore.
Whether it's CBC or CTV or TSN or Sportsnet, at least it's live.
Yeah.
I will adjust my schedule if I'm so inclined, but do not play NBC and put it on at 8 o'clock at night because you want it in prime time and then pretend it's live. And that's what they've been doing for years, and to hell with them. Thank you very much. The next speech will be on Monday. Goodbye, everybody.